We get signal, main screen turn on. You're listening to the radio program about hackers' places. This air level radio program about hackers' places.
We come in peace. Welcome to the 27C3 special of SignalHackerspaces.org. We welcome you to an undisclosed location somewhere in Berlin. And I would like to introduce my panel. And where to start? Start with the guy of the technique. Here's GMC.
Hello, good evening.
May you want to say something? Oh, everyone knows you. It doesn't matter. Then we have some people who may join us later, but we're not to start with a wonderful Nick Farr.
Good evening.
And then we go on with Walter.
Yes, thank you very much. I sometimes do the hacktivism hour, but I have to rebrand it now.
But oh.
Yeah, because hacktivism now is about DDoSing, but we'll talk about it later on, I suppose.
Good, so, and here we have Willow from Seattle. And Steve from Luxembourg.
Hello.
And over there we have Princeton.
Hello, hello.
Good. I think the best thing to start actually is the 27C3. It has been not the first Congress for any of us, but maybe Nick is the one who can kick this topic off, because you really did wonderful job as Herald Angel this year, as all the years before as well.
Oh, thank you very much. I'm actually kind of shocked that it's over. It seems like just a few hours ago we were setting everything up, and then now a big, huge, wonderful thing happened, and they're almost done tearing it down. But no, I think this year was amazingly smooth. Last year was the first year the Congress was really, really crowded, and in the year since last year, we've made a lot of preparations to make sure that some of the overcrowding and some of the more unpleasant things of having to cram some people in were fixed and adjusted, and it turned out we didn't really even need to use a lot of the things that we were preparing for this year. Everybody had plenty of space. All of the really big talks, with two exceptions, everybody was able to get into. People were really, really nice, and this was a really mellow, chill, nice year, pretty much all the way around. The joke in the Orga side was, you know, we're starting to get worried because everything is going a little bit too well. But it was a really fun time. Everybody had a great time, and everybody was really well behaved, basically all the way from a record low number of abuse requests from the rest of the internet in to very few medical requests. Like they said at closing ceremonies, everybody was able to get into talks, and I think nothing out of the ordinary really happened, except all of the wonderful things that are always out of the ordinary when you get 4,000 beautiful, talented hackers from all over the world together in one space.
Yeah, well, it's has been shocking how little chaos there was this year, but the talks were amazing, definitely. And I think it's best to start off with everyone gives some kind of input, the highlights of the Congress, whatever you take with you or
Well, actually, I did not see any talks. I never go to this conference to see talks. I don't know if I'm the only one, but the great thing I'm taking, I've met again so much nice people and made a lot of new friends again and met all the old friends again. That for me is the highlight as always.
It's the surroundings. I mean, if it would be only about the talks, you could watch the recording as well. But especially the show you did with your co-archangel Lindworm, this really was great, and it moved the whole audience. Although you played this gag very intensively, it worked. And I think we can solve this now, and maybe you can tell us something about the zero-day suit story.
Well, the whole zero-day suits thing was was a little unusual. For those of you that don't know, pretty much at every hacker event that I attend, I'm always dressed in a suit. It's just a trademark of mine. I don't think I could get out of it even if I wanted to, for the most part. But Jörn Chen, a Berlin local, very involved with Pheno Elite and pH Neutral, tweeted just pretty randomly one day, "Hey, if Nick wears a suit, or if Nick wears a hoodie and baggy pants on the first day of the Congress, I'll wear a suit." I thought this was somewhat amusing, so I went ahead and retweeted it. And it sort of took on a life of its own from there, and more and more people got involved. And on the first day, I was shocked to see something like 70, 80 people dressed up in, you know, business formal attire, men and women, in all manner of different suits and things like that. And everybody seemed to have a really good time with it. You know, a lot of the things that I do between the talks at Congress started last year. Last year, they had the first, what they called this year, peace mission, but it was a Dragons Everywhere. Last year was the first year that they knew that they were going to sell out, that they knew that they had reached the maximum capacity of the BCC, that the Congress was getting far more popular than they had spaces available for it. And so that's the first year that they started really heavily investing in making sure that the streams were professionally done. And as a consequence of that, as a herald angel, your job is to get the speaker to the stage, make sure all of the technic works, and continue from there. And I was just about to kick off the first really big talk in Saal 1, the main auditorium of the Congress, 15 minutes early when somebody pulled me aside from the orga crew and said, "You can't start this talk early. You have to wait 15 minutes until the people at the streams are expecting to see the talk." So every single talk has to start exactly on time, regardless of whether or not there's a somewhat angry audience that has been packed in and herded in by various room angels and things like that. And so the whole, you know, Nick Farr and friends do comedy in between the talks started as a result of that. And the idea is you have, you know, hackers are not really the best kind of people to be herded and crowded in, and not usually the most socially gracious in situations such as these. So a lot of the people were getting kind of angry, and I thought, you know, what can I possibly do to make this situation better? So we really just started telling silly jokes, doing silly dances, different things like that. And people started to like it. They were laughing. They were having a good time. And the best part about it was that they walked into the room, you know, perhaps a little bit frustrated because of the capacity of the room and having it filled up, but when the talk started, they had forgotten about all of that, that they were laughing or they said, "Oh, that was awful." But regardless, they were warmed up as a crew. And since then, it's been more or less of a tradition for me to go in room one. The other thing is Lindworm was a really good herald angel last year. And it's a firm belief of mine that you should always be looking for, anytime you're in any kind of position of great responsibility or power, you should always be looking for somebody to replace you. You should always be training the next generation. Lindworm was great at the Congress last year, and I told him going to the Congress this year, "Hey, look, I'm going to be relying on you a lot more to be in charge of heralding a lot of the talks and in charge of running the Herald Angels." This year I also had, you know, plenty of help. We were able to develop a new position called Senior Angels. Chef Sven Lindworm and Chantal were able to take that on, and by day two, they were running everything perfectly on their own. I almost had nothing to do. I was joking around with them saying, hey, you know, guys, are you trying to cut me out of everything here? But that obviously wasn't the case at all. That was, of course, was a joke. And they coordinated a vast staff of herald angels that I think exceeded 40 at one time. And with that extra available power, we were able to create a new kind of angel called Mission Angels. And their primary job was to be on IRC, Jabber, and Twitter in each of the talks, and acting as a relay, a human proxy for everybody watching the streams at home who might have a question, might have a comment, but of course would normally have no way of being able to interact with the session, as it were. It was a completely brand new position that we literally thought up on day zero, the evening of day zero, and by day one we had fleshed out an idea and started trying to recruit and plug people into those positions, and by the end of day one the system had worked itself out. One of the beautiful things about Congress is that it's very, very self-organizing. It embraces some of the best aspects of DIY culture. in two ways. One, the organization is very, very good at letting people do things that they think are a good idea. They're not, there's almost no top-down hierarchy in the Congress. They, if somebody comes up with a good idea, and it seems like they say, yeah, go ahead and do it. And of course, the other flip side of that is that the attendees of Congress are always eager to help out and improve things, suggest improvements, and, you know, let themselves be empowered. And so the combination of all of those things, I think, led to a very, very smoothly run Congress where, you know, everybody had a really, really awesome time, and some of the unfortunate things that tend to happen were very, very minimized this year.
Mm. It even had some large-scale effects, this complete collective intelligence, in a way. Because I heard the story from Lindworm when this, all these people were dressed up in suits on day one. Classical media, who was also at the Congress this year, we really had much more media coverage, which took the full event as an issue and put it into radio and TV stations. She made a comment to Lindworm after she interviewed so many of these people in suits that you're destroying my image of hackers here. That's not good, you know. I imagine some, I don't know, dirty young people hanging around, and instead you have very serious, respectable-looking people. And it was just a comment, but it showed how you have side effects that could really have major impact. And another thing you said, these problems that have been increasingly getting worse about the shortage of room. I think Rob put it perfectly in his opening keynote. Either the BCC is getting too small or we are getting too many. And as a side effect of that, but also as, I don't know, a kind of rumor that the Congress is becoming too much social and too less technical, there has been a new event here in Berlin, which is called Berlin Sites. It's located close to the sea base. And we also want to talk about this, and therefore I would like to ask Brimstone about it.
Yeah, Berlinside seems to be a spin-off of the B-Sides concept that seems to be up and coming with these major cons, in that it's much like the LPs or cassette tape music of days gone past. It's the content that the speakers really want to get out to show that's not what the con wants them to present, more so that they can just show off or talk about whatever they want, what their true passion is.
Would you like to make a comparison between these two conferences, or is this completely nonsense in this case?
You could make comparisons, but it's a lot easier to make contrasts. 27C3 had like 4,000 people or something in attendance. Berlinside had like 60. 27C3 went for 4 days and had hours and hours of talks, and Berlinside was like 3 days, mm-hmm. A little bit less.
I think it's really nice that the larger conference is paying attention to the social ramifications of the acts that people make, but I understand that I spoke at Berlin Sides as well, and it was more of a social impact on the education system, which we'll get to later, but I like the focus that happened at Berlin Sides, but I understand why it moves towards that at 27C3.
Mm-hmm. But the question is how this will be in the next year or in the upcoming years, because is it really the way to go that these things split up, that you have several conferences or events at the same time in Berlin at one place? Or
This is Philippe Langlois from Temp Lab speaking. And what we did in our event is, instead of growing and becoming a bigger and bigger and bigger event, we choose to split like mitosis, like cells that split in an organic system, so that diversity could occur faster. And by having not HSF, the Hackerspace Festival, become a major event, but trying to have HSF split in many little events like Akito Ergosum, like Estive Numérique, either the security side, the camping side, or whatever people choose to have in their local city, was the way we chose so that we wouldn't face the choice, for example, of staying in the BCC because we like the people, but it's too small, and not getting into paradoxes, we did not choose, because we have many paradoxes to explore, and it's cool. But these ones, we didn't want to run into them. So that was our own organic solution, and of course, it's not like a perfect recipe. The cool thing is that mutation happens very fast, and having an ecosystem with B-sides coming to say, okay, we mutate the concept and do it, it's beautiful, I think.
Well, I was just wondering, because I quite like the idea of cell division of cons in order to retain the intimacy of a con, instead of getting this massive anonymous rock festival-like event. At the same time, I'm wondering, I wasn't even aware about the B-Sides event until I came into the studio, how you retain, and there's other thing, which is interoperability. How can you enable people to pick and choose from the various cons which are running in parallel?
My side on it is, first, life is not a supermarket, so you can't pick and choose, because the kind of hallucination of having a perfect choice in a perfect system doesn't exist. The Adam Smith's hand, or invisible hand, is giving you the finger all the time. So the thing is, what I think is really, you'll have emergence of island of knowledge, an island of community coming, and then these will merge and people will know about it, but don't try to be so French somehow, wanting the perfect system. And we suck at that, so I can speak about it. It's
wanting to be too French, actually. This is tips to the head, by the way. You managed to push exactly the wrong button with me here. I quite like your remarks about Adam Smith's invisible hand, though. Nonetheless, people are all the time moaning about events becoming inside a cable, etc. And you have to know the right people to get into CCC Congress and all that, which is partly bollocks. I mean, I was a complete outsider 3 years ago, and I've managed to get tickets so far every year. And I'm fairly stupid, not as smart as the average hacker. But nonetheless, people will always take that kind of money serious. How are you going to counter that with this model of cell division?
To me here, and I fully agree with that, the hacker community is quite good enough at being open, so that even though you say, oh, fuck, I wanted to be there, I wanted to be part of it, you can still come next year, and the learning curve is not that steep. It's a welcoming curve and a loving family. So here, I don't think the difficulty of coping with the fast cell division is going really to be a problem. Really, I think we should not aim, once again, at having a perfect system, but trying to cope with change. It's going to be always there. We're good at it, I think.
Especially because the community is growing so much, it's really nice that there's a live stream, because you can still know what happened. And I don't know if all the events that you're talking about that are more cellular occur at the same time in the same city, but that's what I really liked about B-Sides and CCC happening at the same time, because I could bounce between them, and even if I couldn't get into one, I could have still spent time with the people that attended both.
I think what we're going to be seeing with this event is something similar to the Berlin Film Festival, the Berlinale, where you have various different venues all agreeing to be doing a festival at exactly the same time. And we're going to be going from a Congress, which is centrally located in one spot, into a time of year between Christmas and New Year's that's universally recognized, and many people are able to get time off for it to come to Berlin and gather and do their own events. And I absolutely agree with Philippe's idea of cellular division, and I think the thing that we really have to respect B-Sides for is that they took an incredible amount of initiative. Alec, who is a good friend of mine, even though perhaps he's a little bit too frustrated with the Congress, by the time Congress started and we were all getting together, working out our differences, really have set a tradition of being in Berlin between Christmas and New Year's for the hacker community, and saying, hey, we are going to be here, we're going to run our own events, even though we may not be perfectly going to Congress or perfectly going to Berlin Sides, the tradition is set. If somebody wants to run their own event here in Berlin, I think that's what we're going to see next year. And it's a beautiful and wonderful thing that we have people coming together and not necessarily creating their own events or trying to segment the community, but exactly as Willow said, creating many different smaller events with each their own focus to maximize the enjoyment and the productivity and the use of time that we have coming here to Berlin in a very, very cold time of the year. That's the irony. It's very, very cold outside, but you know, whether you're going to Berlin Sides, whether you're going to Congress, or whether you're just going to a flat where you've got, you know, 20 hackers spread out in a small room that you're crashing out in, the warmth and the feeling and the passion for technology, for digital rights, for all of the things that are important to us and that we discuss is unparalleled anywhere else at any other time of the year, in my opinion. But of course, I'm a little biased.
Yeah, I think definitely the thing you said about traditions is absolutely correct. And the CCC managed to be in a unique position when you compare it to any other conference. But we really shouldn't be worried, because I at least hope that the community is intelligent enough to see diversity as something good and this shortage of space and as nothing negative. Instead, we should be happy that we became so many. And also the live stream concept you mentioned should bring us to the next point I would like to discuss with you, which is going into the basic foundation of what the Congress once was. It's the topic about education in hackerspaces. And I think with Mitch Altman, we have here the perfect person to start this topic off.
About education in hackerspaces? Having started a hackerspace in the United States, which is especially problematic in teaching its younger citizens anything needed to live a fulfilling life. But this is true with the world at large to varying degrees. The education system is really failing all of us. And if we're not teaching our kids how to live a life that they enjoy and find fulfilling, then we don't have a future. And in the United States, all the education system is really geared only for standardized tests. The rationalization is that we want to have a high quality and we need to quantify the quality of teaching, and they have these standardized tests in order to measure that. But it's totally the opposite result. Kids are being taught to take these tests because the bureaucracy in each school will lose its funding if the school does not do well on the kids' standardized tests. So teachers are not allowed to teach anything that's actually useful. They'll get fired otherwise. So it's up to everyone else to try to fill in the gaps. And I see hackerspaces as a really great place to provide places for kids to actually come in and learn what they want to learn, things that are actually very useful for them and practical as well. So NoiseBridge is very open. We have no age restrictions whatsoever. We have a lot of middle school and high school kids coming during lunchtime and after school and during weekends, and they learn with each other and with other people who are willing to help them. It's all very free and open. We also have many classes which are attended by people of all ages and workshops. So, and I see other hackerspaces filling this role as well. Not just hackerspaces, but many other community-oriented nonprofit groups. But hackerspaces in particular are well-suited for this because we have people, very diverse people, into very many topics that we are all enthusiastic about, because that's the salient feature of hackerspaces. We do what we do because we love it, whether or not it makes us money. And I think that's a fantastic environment for learning.
Willie, would you like to continue? I think you have the perfect talking point.
Sure thing. The larger organization that I'm a part of is actually called the School Factory. So when James Carlson started Bucketworks in 2002, which is a 27,000 square foot hacker maker co-working space in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, it's amazing. And he separated out the thing that would make spaces like this from the space that he was building itself. And now, 8 years later, he's finally found a group of people that will help him do this. I'm one of them. And so part of it is the Space Federation, which we can talk about later if you want. But the end point is these are the spaces that are the new schools. And people have been trying to alter the education system for so long, and it's too bureaucratic. It's not worth it to dump all your time and energy into trying to fix a broken system. We're just going to do it better and then slowly take over. So we're working on linking up hacker and maker spaces to local schools to encourage field trips, definitely encouraging parents to bring in their kids, linking up with 826, which does things like the space travel supply store in Seattle, and they have a superhero supply store in New York, and just silly, but they're fronts for teaching kids. So they have writing workshops, but they only do English writing. So we're going to teach them how to write code, too. So we're trying to produce new schools and actually come out with a certification system as well with emergent testing, so it will be more reliable than standardized testing, so we can still have the legitimacy that people look for, so that it will be easier and easier to rival the existing system.
But you're not only doing this as one space, you're really aiming for making this a network of several spaces.
Yes. So Bucketworks in Milwaukee, that's been around for a long time. Jigsaw Renaissance, which is in Seattle, which started, it's been in existence for a year now. That's where I hail from. And then we also have Sector 67 in Madison, Wisconsin, which opened a couple months ago. Pumping Station 1 in Chicago, Level 1 in Louisville are jumping on. Part of that is the Space Federation. We're automating the parts that suck. We don't want to do paperwork in our hacker spaces and our maker spaces. We want to do the stuff we're there to do. And so part of that is that we're taking, the School Factory takes care of, we'll file your paperwork for you. We will give you fiscal sponsorship. You don't have to participate with the School Factory in order to have that conversation or have access to the information. I don't know if I'm getting too far off topic.
No, I'd like to know, can you automate all these tasks, or do you have volunteers who do the paperwork and all that stuff?
A certain amount of it has to be done by volunteers right now, but we're working on automating as much of it as possible.
Great. Philippe wants to say something? Yeah.
One thing that is important is being always open of the aware of the open externalities that are outside of our domain, and we're quite, there's many things happening in the hackerspace domain that it's sometimes difficult to keep up with also all the things that are happening out there. And in terms of these, there are initiatives in education which are very interesting. For example, you know the Fab Lab movement that's happening, and with the MIT route. Well, the people who receive the Fab Lab equipment in India are actually running a school there. And it's part of different networks. There's even the Bricolabs network, which is very close to it. And these people are doing very interesting things and are participating to other education networks, such as WiserU, which is trying to reform the universities. And one thing that is very important is that these people are very open to being to hosting hackers coming from all the hacker spaces in their space in Colombia with Nueva Escuela, in India with these people around the Fab Labs, to actually teach half of the time, and half of the other time it's free to them. So there's many open externalities that are great, that are happening right now. But one thing that we must always be aware is not to be too much self-centered, because even though our own projects are very important, sometimes when you're, you know, running the bike, it's somehow difficult to see as a countryside out there.
Very interesting what you just said. I mean, freedom of knowledge is one of the central key values in the hacker culture. But for me, at least, I mean, I'm not that old, it looks like there has been a shift that more and more this freedom of knowledge is also understood in a way that we want to spread the knowledge outside of our community and really reach out to other parts of society or to journalism and media. And there definitely is still a lot to gain when we think about how could we interpretate a lot of the technical knowledge, which is mostly too complicated for the wider public to understand. I mean, we definitely see it in political issues that it is important to have it translated and made it easy enough to understand for complex political issues.
I'm going to disagree just slightly in saying that a lot of the technical things that we look at are too complicated for people to understand. I think fundamentally humans are much more similar than they are different. I think every human is born with a certain capacity to understand things, and there are far more people out there who have the intrinsic ability to understand these things. But the problem, going back to what Mitch said about education, is that people are socialized out of a lot of the skills and the understanding here, and that the focus on, you know, the role of the public school system generally in Western societies is to socialize people for work, for simple repetitive tasks that don't involve a lot of creativity, insight, or foresight. And any study that you look at that asks why students are dropping out of school or why people are disengaging from the education system is because they're bored. You know, kids have such, I mean, younger people have such an intensive need to explore, to create, to engage their minds, to do all of the things that are happening at hackerspaces, which is why hackerspaces are such magnets for young people and are essential to the education system that we need to create in order to, in order to turn Western society from an economy based around making things and building value by creating stuff to building value by creating and sharing ideas, that hackers are not only on the forefront of understanding the ramifications and the possibilities of all the technical systems, but are on the forefront of understanding how these technical systems are going to change politics, how these technical systems are going to create the economies and the futures of tomorrow. And it's, you know, hackerspaces, I think, are an essential and undervalued portion of that, that they're fundamentally completely open laboratories for exploring all of these different things. And that's, and it's not, it's a sign of the future because the hackerspaces I'm seeing are independently organized, independently run groups of people that come together around their passions and around their groups, but are not about themselves and are not as selfish as you might think, but are part of a global movement and very much value the fact that they are part of a global movement and value the fact that they have the technical ability and the willingness to collaborate with their colleagues all over the world in creating and really laying the groundwork for what the future is going to look like. A lot of people look at the public school system, they look at the collapse of financial economies, they look at a society that is showing all signs of failure. You know, if you look at the historical precedents of Western society versus the end times of the Roman Empire, the results are shocking. And Mitch knows a lot more about this than I do about the end of the quote-unquote American Empire. But every time I look at hackerspaces, every time I visit a new hackerspace, every time I go to a congress, I'm filled with, you know, nothing but hope for the future. That hackers are taking, are not taking over in the violent sense, but picking up where institutions have left off. You know, in terms of education, the public education system has largely failed. And hackers and hackerspaces are picking up that ball and running with it and creating the future of education. I think this extends to everything from the development of the internet to space travel. Perhaps I'm going way off on a tangent here, but I think, you know, governments have failed at what is possibly the most fundamentally important future development of our species. You know, if you were an outside species studying the history of the planet Earth over the past 100 years, and you saw that in the early 1970s, you know, 1972, the life forms on this planet got to their nearest moon. And then 40 years later, they haven't gone back. You know, this the parallel would be as if Christopher Columbus landed in the Americas, turned back, and then they let it just kind of sit there. Yep, you know, we know the Americas are out there. We know there's stuff out there. We know, you know, but well, yeah, we're not that interested in it. You know, the selfishness of a lot of the selfishness and the navel gazing and the waste of value of intellectual capital and material resources of our society are tremendous. And I think hackers, instead of throwing up their hands and saying, oh, woe is me, you know, oh, this is so bad, and wasting more and more time and resources complaining about the problem, are putting themselves out about it, working at solving it, and achieving the impossible. And if we've seen nothing from the hackerspaces movement over the past 4 years, is that hackers set out to do the impossible and don't let anybody tell them that it's not.
Yeah, well, I wanted to go back on the point of, you know, doing what we do. A lot of people in the hacker scene and the hacker movement are incredibly brilliant. In fact, most of us are. And we're incredibly passionate, so we spend a lot of time in these things that we're enthusiastic about. The thing is, though, that we're in a unique position to be able to explain what we do through our enthusiasm to others and making it easy. So people are often intimidated by things they don't understand, and technology is certainly a huge realm that's taken over so much of society, and people at large don't really understand it, and it's not being taught in our schools. In fact, it's being cut out, math and science and technology. It's a huge, important part. Little kids pick up on it so easily. Anyone can. I mean, I've taught things that people consider to be totally out there and weird and scary and electronic to people ages 4 to the oldest person I taught to solder was 83. Everyone thinks that I can't do this because it's just so out there. And yet there hasn't been a single person I've been unable to teach to do these things and to give an understanding of what they're doing. You know, we can all do that. It's not difficult stuff. If we understand it, we can explain it to other people. that was one of the things of Richard Feynman. He's like, if you have a good understanding of it, you can explain it in a few words to someone so they get an idea of what's going on, no matter how complex. So again, you know, hackerspaces are a place full of these kind of people who know their stuff and can explain it to others. You know, and again, about education. The education system, you know, just think about school. What did you go through in school? You go to a place at a particular time, way too early in the morning, when it's totally proven an inadequate time to learn. It's much better after you've woken up a bit, but very much like going to work. And it's not only that, but it's an obsolete work because it's in rows and columns, responding, reacting to bells at a specific time throughout the day. This is teaching people to do, as you said, Nick, repetitive tasks for the industrial era, which is dead. Any place in the United States which was big in the industrial era is dead. I mean, look at Detroit, where you were born, Nick. You know, and I've been there a bunch of times. What used to exist there is just gone and decaying, and it's really, really sad. And yet, people in the hackerspace movement are seeing that as an opportunity, and there's so much growth from the rubble of Detroit, the leftovers of the industrial era that are left over that we can use in new ways, because that's what we do. We repurpose things. That's one of the things we do. And we can make use of the same thing with education. You know, like, we're not competing with education. We're not competing with society at large. We're actually creating parallels that people can choose if they like. And it's really a powerful place to be. It's an incredible opportunity. All of society right now seems to be freaking out, and there's people who are desperate to try to make the old ways work again. What we're seeing now, I believe, is actually the beginning of much, much bigger problems. So people are entering the room, and there should be more interesting conversations as a result.
We are nearly complete. We are complete for now. Astera sadly can't come, but I don't want to interrupt this discussion. So, Willem, may you please go on.
I just want to make one more point. The future of education, I think, again, is perfect for hackerspaces are well suited to fill the role because it's really about learning by doing. And the economies that are working now anywhere in the world are ones where people use their creativity to provide services for other people. And hackerspaces are nothing without a space of to get together in community, to express ourselves through creativity. And this is a fantastic way to learn. And education, the future of everything, including education, is there.
One of the main things that we've been missing is in our current education system is that we don't teach people that systems are malleable. We just teach them how to be a part of the system. And so what I love about hackers is that they understand that because they can take apart a laptop, as an example, that means that their education system is malleable. Their city system is malleable. You can go to a place that sucks and fix it. This is sort of a segue from that, but I used to think there was a big difference between hackerspaces and makerspaces, and Mitch very poignantly told me that makers are just people who are scared of the word hacker. So I think makerspaces more and more are that intro, that gateway, for people who know that there must be more, but are scared of how much that could mean. So people that are scared to go to hackerspaces will go to makerspaces because people, it's a little bit more extroverted and people are like, no, we'll sit down and just, we'll teach you how to solder. And that happens at hackerspaces too. It's just people are a little bit more scared of it. So I like to think of them as the gateway drug to learning. And then the hackerspaces are the more like where there's more concentration and focus. But I think that divide is becoming more and more arbitrary and non-existent.
Okay. One comment about changing the structure we're in is that what we've learned from governments and education systems is that these big systems, big architecture that are very heavy are hard to change. So I think what is very important is that whenever we evolve as an ecosystem, that we are all the hacker spaces, all the hack labs and maker spaces, is to keep the structure light. And this light structure, I think, by the network, is something that we exemplified as doable, scalable, and the scalability is always where governments say, yeah, but you'll suck at organizing 100,000 people. Well, in terms of hackers, we're more than that. So what is very interesting here is that the exact points where they were saying, well, people can't handle themselves. Anarchy somehow is for a lunatic that knows that humans can't be self-managed. Somehow we are proving that we're not, maybe all of us are not anarchists, but we are so far quite self-managed and quite reasonable at it.
No, I absolutely agree with Philippe's point here, and I think hackerspaces.org is a perfect example of that. You know, here we have a central collaboration point for hackerspaces around the world where we don't preoccupy ourselves with bureaucratic questions like who belongs or who doesn't. You know, are you hackers in a space making, creating things? Okay, you're a hackerspace. It doesn't matter whether, you know, you happen to be a research lab of a corporation or a squat in Sweden that happens to be working on technology. And that's, going back to the Congress, this is a perfect example of that. Congress is very self-organized. You know, just the whole idea of mission angels didn't exist, you know, when until the early morning of day one. And we put the idea out there, we asked for help, and it organized itself. I didn't have to write a plan. I didn't have to issue orders. I didn't have to have meetings to make it happen. I said, hey, here's this idea, and you guys can help out or not. It's the same thing in the hackerspaces movement, and this is the same thing of what's going to happen. I think a lot of these failing bureaucracies, and I don't mean failing in the harsher sense, I just mean that they're not evolving as fast as our society is evolving, that the beauty of the Hackerspaces movement is that we're actually teaching and showing people not only how to think for themselves, but how to do for themselves. And that we don't need structures and large things like that. I think what they're doing in Detroit is that they're taking the fallen rubble of a lot of these industrial structures, melting them down and turning them into smaller, lighter, faster, much more collaborative, and structures that need not think in terms of scalability or need not think in terms of bureaucracy, that they adapt and collaborate much more quickly than anything else we've seen in human history. And at the same time, about the terminology, if you had told me, you know, even 4 years ago, that any person from the news media would use the term hacker in a positive light, I would have said that you're crazy. That's never going to happen. That's a goal that we'll see 10 years in the future. And now we have articles on Hackerspaces that are 3-4 years old that are referencing hacker in a very in a good light. That at least now the common average, you know, reasonably well-connected middle class person in Kansas will say, "Oh, are you the good kind of hacker or the bad kind of hacker?" And just reaching that fundamental distinction, you know, in such a short period of time is a testament to the great work that hackers have been doing all over in Hackerspaces and on their own, and the fact that we don't need large bureaucratic structures. We don't need these things that we will organize and we will do if you give people just a little bit of trust and a little bit of knowledge and a little bit of control. And I think Mitch's workshops throughout the world are a classic example of this, that people put these walls and barriers in front of themselves, that they're socialized to think that they're, you know, they fit in a little box, that they have a little purpose, that they have a specialized job title, and that's who they are, and that's what they do, and that's, you know, what they're all about. I think what the work that we're doing, and Mitch is a classic example of this, is helping people remove those walls for themselves. You know, it never fails that I'll see one person at a conference who literally learned how to solder right there, and then 6 months later, they're on some of the cutting edges of hardware hacking development. You know, that the thought that a person whose full-time job is not technology can go from soldering a TV beacon kit, having never soldered anything before, to giving me pointers on surface mount soldering in 6 months is amazing. And this is not an anomaly. This is a common thing. And hackers are at the forefront of, you know, the quote-unquote, not to use a tired term, but the world of tomorrow, that people who are starting to learn the hacker mentality of doing it and learning it for yourself are starting to build.
There has been a lot of truth what just said. I mean, for me, this central concept is always the decentral organization, which is the fundamental basement of the internet or other decentral systems. And we just have learned this concept so well, now use it in many various ways, how we try to use it on social levels or on cultural levels. And I mean, in 2010, when we look back, I mean, we will come to WikiLeaks later. We only want to have a cut on that. But I definitely see there that everything we've been talking for years now has become mainstream. I mean, my mother asked me about what are these conferences you're going to? I mean, it really went through the ceiling. And I think it is even more important now that we explain ourselves, that we really try to make clear what we stand for and where in society we understand ourselves, because otherwise other people will come. And it has been in the past that the word hacker has been used in a very specific way, and thankfully we are away from that. At least when I look at Germany, they have now reached in the public reception of the Chaos Computer Club such an enormous positive stance that it would need a lot to destroy that in the future. But yeah, I think Walter again, who wants to say something?
Well, I'm going to dissent here and there a bit. I feel that the idea of public schooling being a system to kind of brainwash people into being cogs in an industrial machine, it's the end result, but may not have been necessarily the intention, especially when you look to the distinction between some European systems of public education versus the United States high school system. Germany still has this concept of trade schools, which is still very strong. The Netherlands still has it. Belgium has it to a certain extent. England kind of abandoned it. But the end result was, for very different motives, that we kind of are abandoning the idea of people learning a trade in school, because the idea was, from a social democratic viewpoint, that every child should have the chance to become a musician or a writer or etc. And at the same time, they're making it's the same mistake. Not all people have at all stages in life the same style of learning. Lots of people learn by doing, like Mitch said. Some other people learn basically by moving the body. I mean, many dancers I've met are not quite fit to sit still in a classroom. And others are much better off at some stage in life at just doing stuff with their hands. And I feel makerspaces or hackerspaces, which are essentially the same thing, is can do, regardless of what we can do in terms of scalability, etc., is to the idea of dissecting stuff and creating stuff is to make it cool again. That it becomes cool to do some woodcrafting, to do some metalworking, or to do some electronics. And that's something which has been, I think, one of the most disturbing phenomena in media for the past few decades, that it's not cool to make stuff. It's only cool to market it. And in that sense, as a liberal who believes in the invisible hand of... I'm sorry about that, Philippe. I think it's a very kind of cleansing event that we had the credit crisis, because in the past 20 years, everybody was saying, well, the service industry, that's where things are going. And at the end of the day, it turned out to be mostly humbug and hot air. And now we've moved stuff to China as the workshop of the world. And all of a sudden, oil is becoming more expensive, and then all the shipping stuff back and forth may not have been such a good idea. So we may actually be on the cusp of a new era where making stuff is cool again. And we can be part of that.
I mean, look at, when I was growing up, being a geek was not okay. And I was beaten up every day for it. I mean, literally beaten up for it and brutally bullied for being an introverted geek. And now I wouldn't say it's actually cool to be an introverted geek, but it's not as horrible and people aren't beaten up so much and bullied for it. And because, our world is so much formed by the technology in all of our lives, for better and worse, but society at large, everyone in it knows that this technology is important. And they look at geeks who understand all this stuff, and people are maybe a little bit even afraid of us because we understand things that they don't have a clue about. And hackerspaces are full of people who are saying, no, it's not scary, it's really cool. Come on, check it out. We're really, come on. And people are responding very positively to that, including people in the mainstream press. So, like you said, we're at the beginning of something pretty exciting.
Yeah. Actually, it is quite tremendous when you see how many people come to the hacker scene, and it looks sometimes that we would have all the answers to this more complex world, because we have been around, we worked with complex systems somehow, we already made most of them, and the risk I can see here is that some people think at the end of the day, when the governments fuck everything up, the hackers will come and save us, which is also won't be the case. We certainly don't have all the answers. We have some good concepts which perfectly suit our time and this system of consumer one-way media, where it would be so easy just to get your role and work it up. But actually, I think we have to be very clear also in our self-understanding, and be always open. This is probably the central reason why the whole hacker thing is still alive and so well connected in a society, because we have open doors.
I think that what you just said, I have to highlight on note of hackers represent the vanguard of a fundamental shift in mentality in our community and the work that we're doing, and what the things like the self-organizing, the sorts of things that happened at Congress lead me to believe that no, hackers are not going to and, you know, quote unquote, save you, you know, when the government's failed. The hackers are going to give you the tools and the knowledge to let you save yourself when governments fail. That's fundamentally what we're doing here.
Okay, we will play some music now, but we should be back with you in a few minutes. Thank you. Okay, and here we are back again. We would now continue this issue on education, but point in a bit different direction, because we are here a radio program or podcast, whatever you want to see it when you listen to it. We have here a very special guest we want to talk about with you about the general way of using radio as a medium for this community. And therefore, I would like to welcome Emmanuel Goldstein to the show.
Why, thank you.
Yeah.
This is really cool being here, by the way.
Oh, yeah, we have quite a very cool location here, but sadly we can show you the photos. Yeah, I think you have been around in this business much, much longer than we are. And maybe you can give us some of your experience, what it's like to use this medium of voice for this community. And
out there that everybody hears all the time in department stores, the same songs, the same commercials. And at some point, consumers are going to ask, why would I listen to this when I can get the same effect by shuffling an iPod or downloading music that I feel like listening to? Why listen to some horrible DJ say something? Why listen to all these commercials? The real power of radio is the conversation, is the engagement, is getting people to listen, to shout at their radio, to call in, to participate. And I think accessibility is essential for that. And that's one thing that you can never really replace when it's over the airwaves.
Yeah. Just about what you said, I would like to give the word to GMC and say something about Signal and about the implications we have for this project here.
Yeah, I don't really know what to say about this because I was very busy with the mixing desk. But I mean, first of all, Off the Hook was a great inspiration for me to do this whole Signal project, actually. I mean, listening to the Off the Hook show, it's a fun show to listen to. You have a group of people who are knowledgeable about technology and politics, and they sit around and discuss it, and people even get the magic that Emmanuel mentions. People even call in and give their opinion on that. I'm not sure exactly if we cannot do that because, of course, there's a slight difference, I think, in the audience we're aiming for. And correct me if I'm wrong, but Off the Hook is also more aimed at, well, the people that are driving in the car and tune in and find the program. And then, well, we are actually explicitly targeting people from hackerspaces, people from the community. So those people generally will find us on the internet because we tweet about it and it retweeted and someone sees it and then thinks, oh, let's tune in for a change. And, well, I really hope we can get some more of that spontaneous input in the programs by people calling in. We are actually working on that and we do get a lot of people in also by phone, but it would be great if we could do more call-ins. I'd love that, to get all that input from the audience out there.
Media, this medium we are working in here, the voice is something very universal, and I'm sure we are not at the end of the line. But I can perfectly refer to what Manuel said with this magic you have in this medium. I mean, I wouldn't be in the hacker scene if there wouldn't have been the podcasts from the CCC. This really was the first connection I had into the scene. And from this moment onwards, I never really got away from it. It really catched me. And before I had any images, I had these voices in my head, in my ear. And of course, each medium has its own characteristics, and you can never completely reproduce this style. I mean, you can still see it with Polaroids. There are now even iPhone apps which try to reproduce this unique visual filtering you have. And we just have to recognize that whatever channel you use, you have implications that follow with it. And the Signal is really new. We just to say something about it, you know. We are here for 3 or 4 months, and it really is at the starting point. And we are only those who were in the group of people who were asked first. But the way we understand ourselves in this just basement or I don't know, it's nothing else than hackerspaces.org itself. It just is an empowerment platform where people can come and do cool stuff. And especially because 2011 is something we have not really talked about a lot. Whoever has a good idea is again invited to join us.
What I like so much about radio is that it enforces serendipity. That's why a lot of us found out about new things through it. You can fall down the rabbit hole in the internet of the things that you love, and that's fantastic. But having radio when you're listening in your car and you just have to listen to whatever comes on next, it's like a shared RSS feed where everybody's just dumping in random stuff and there's one person filtering it. So I would like to suggest that we just do a broadcast where somebody picks out their favorite podcast and throws it on the air, and then you can still have people call in, and that's could be a way to mesh those two worlds together.
I like to add to that, as Thomas said, it's not the end of the line. What I really like about radio is that it allows you to do something else. It's probably also a vehicle for serendipity, because when you're checking out whatever social medium du jour, whether it is diaspora or Facebook or something, but you have to watch your screen, you have to tap keys or a visual keyboard, etc., which is very distracting. So there's an upper ceiling to the amount of time you can spend on it when you have a job or otherwise something resembling a life. With radio, you can shoehorn much more radio in your life than you can shoehorn in IRC, Amazon, Facebook, or whatever other medium. Television is even worse, because it's kind of taxes all your faculties basically and leaves you numb and dumb afterwards. Radio allows you to at least with half an ear open, if it, like we say in Dutch, to listen to a conversation and to think about it.
At the Syndicate in Luxembourg, we also have a bi-monthly radio show, and that was a great way for us to, first of all, have great content and easy content, because we do the radio show usually live about a nice subject. It's content in our native language, which was also a nice side effect. And the fact that we use Creative Commons music gives us the advantage of putting it online. A commercial radio station or other that use popular artists, they are bound to some weird laws. And I think in Germany, because I actually watched the talk, that it's even weirder. You can leave the content there for 7 days or 7 months, and then you have to take it away. And these boundaries we do not know, and that's a great power you should actually use. And I think every hackerspace should have some sort of a get together where they just open the mic, talk about something cool, and put it on the web afterwards.
Yeah, this 7 day concept is definitely not the future. We have to move on as time passes by, and because today we also said we want to look back on 2010, there is one issue we cannot leave out, which is WikiLeaks. And we don't want to repeat, thousand discussion of general WikiLeaks issues. I would like to give this round here a bit more of a focus, which is a technical one in this time. What would be the technical stance when we analyze WikiLeaks and the situation that there will be more leaking platforms popping up in the future? Because the concept is now so popular, and there already have been some announcement. OpenLeaks is the one most famous one, because Daniel Domscheit-Berg, but others have been mentioned in the media as well. And the interesting question I would like to ask is that WikiLeaks used very complicated technique of anonymization through the network, but then also in the analyzing of the document to really get every hint, every proof out of the metadata, but also a journalistical analysis of the document, that you anonymize third persons mentioned in the document, for example, like they did in the diplomatic cables and then some of the war logs. And this type of, this new issue, this new type of software, of network standards, of knowledge, which the society strongly demands right at the moment, when you look at how many of these platforms pop up or are mentioned in the media. And does any of you think that this is something where the hacker scene or the hacker culture should step on, and should we take this as an issue? Should we try to produce some leaking technology which is really bulletproof, or at least in the terms of open source software?
Well, I personally wouldn't want to take on the responsibility, but I think we do have a responsibility there. A recent example in the Netherlands, we have now a leaking platform, open.nu. It was started by someone who really does not have a clue about the technology behind anonymization. Some of our friends, they looked at the site and they just discovered they were running vulnerable software. There were SQL injections in there. If you upload your document there, that's the technology part. There was also the whole policy of how these documents would be spread. It's just not protecting.
Whether or not this document should be available for the community on the net or not.
Julian Assange was crushed by Stephen Colbert in his show over the infamous video of the helicopter shooting of journalists. At the end of the day, I find it very sad that WikiLeaks was necessary to release so much information which should not have been classified to begin with. And as Steve said, the real heroes in the story are the whistleblowers. At some point in time, you get to the point where people feel that their fundamental values are being violated by information being kept classified. And to me, that's the only parallel with the Pentagon Papers. And so far, people have been bitching in the media about whether Sarkozy is a prick or not. Well, we all already know he is a prick. The issue should be, why was all this information classified? Sarkozy being called a prick in diplomatic circles, I think that should remain classified. That's not how diplomacy works to begin with. But a lot of other information which was leaked should not have been classified to begin with. And that the conversation should be about that.
I know that this is a much smaller scale thing, but there are OpenGov things happening, and I know that it's not at all at the level of the information that was on WikiLeaks, but there is some movement towards that. I know it's not sufficient, but I do want to pay some lip service to that some smaller cities are figuring out that they should open up some things at least.
Well, just to get to that, yes, I think especially in smaller communities are realizing that they can make government much more effective by opening it up, or by opening up their data, opening up their geographical information systems, opening up a lot of their functions of state, local, municipal governments, and allow people to connect and request services from their government and report trouble of things that in their governments, in these open government initiatives. And yes, I think those have a net much more meaningful impact to people's daily lives than something like a WikiLeaks. I think that the WikiLeaks incident shows us, that especially with the diplomatic cables, it's not so much that WikiLeaks is changing, you know, the planet or changing diplomacy as much as it is a harbinger of the fact that the way diplomacy is conducted is going to have to change. That the idea of everything that you say is, you know, between you and your government is secret, you know, that sort of sanctity of secrecy by which diplomacy is practiced is going to disappear, and that's a good thing. You know, governments should have a consistent policy, they should say what they mean, and they shouldn't have to go around through flowery language in order to conduct business with each other, you know, with other sovereign nations. At the same time, that you know, in a larger extent, the ability of sovereign nations to influence things is getting much less. The meaningfulness of borders is thankfully starting to erode. You know, I mean, the European Union is a, you know, shining hallmark of that. The fact that you can, you know, travel from, you know, the shore of France to the other side of Poland, going through many national borders, including possibly Luxembourg, if one was so inclined, without having to stop and show your papers is amazing. It's something that the United States has, of course, had since its inception. And we're going to keep on seeing more and more of those things, that progressive governments and economies are going to realize that borders cost money. And as energy prices go up, as labor prices go up, A lot of these externalities that involve things such as borders, people are going to demand to disappear.
At the same time, we reinstate borders by putting up an ACTA agreement, which is the anti-counterfeit trade agreement, where all of a sudden the border can take your digital device and search it for any copyright infringing data, which kind of means, hey, we are building up borders again, and that's kind of very, very, very scary. And no one knows about that. At least in my country, it's kind of unknown and secret. So, Nick.
And as much as I do believe that ACTA is fundamentally a violation of the UN Charter in many different ways, what is the response of our community to that? To start making more Creative Commons licensed content that has absolutely nothing to do with that sort of thing. And I think that the more governments and bureaucracies try to push and impose their will, or are used by people who have vested interests to protect in copyright and trademark regimes, the more it's turning out to be counterproductive, because communities such as ours are realizing that they can realize much more value and are much more likely to earn a living and gain exposure by releasing their works for free and having people pay for the value of creating it in ways that don't involve licensing the ability to copy a recording of the work.
But I still would ask the question if states are really the right targets to aim for right now. I mean, for sure, there have been many things we have been complaining about when it comes to state policies. But when you look at the overall situation, I'm looking forward to the leaks Assange said he would publish in 2011 about the internal workings of banks in an interview with Forbes magazine, because for me this personally is the more pressing issue right now. And when you look at the philosophical basement of this project, I mean, it is not completely unknown. You can look at the things Julian Assange published, and from this perspective, it makes a lot of sense that they, in one way, just want to redistribute this knowledge of power, but on the other way, it's also, as he said in Conspiracy as Governance, a way to put pressure on this secret information channels. And in a way, they already achieved that by reducing the access to the SERPANET, to the restricted military databases in the US. But really, this is, again, it's something that Val Holland said in the 80s, that we had such a strong increase in surveillance of normal citizens, and with data retention is just the last one, which is the most obvious political move in this direction. And when we look back now, this is maybe one step in the other direction, that the information about the internal workings of the state and their secret communication between each other is now available public on the internet. That we can understand both ways why society is here.
I think the new borders are just between meat space and the internet. We're just establishing new boundaries instead. And that makes the terminology of this being the first war, internet war, that much more accurate.
Second, just to say, leaks, which I opening up systems that were by their very nature designed to be open and in practice no longer are.
Just to make this clear, I think this is, as an Austrian, I never started to believe in my government or in any government on the whole world. This is maybe a cultural issue.
Well, I tend to agree that WikiLeaks tend to be irresponsible to a certain extent. I vehemently disagree with the notion that all information should be exposed, that sovereign governments should not be able to have a certain amount of being able to weasel word around the truth, because at the end of the day, all human communication is just elbow rubbing and not really sharing the truth. And you cannot have any form of society where it's the fundamental actor is the individual or the state or a nation state without at certain points of time being able to paint a more rosy picture of reality than reality is. And I quite like the analysis of Clay Shirky saying, well, you cannot be a human person without being able to separate contexts. You're a different person towards your spouse, towards your parents, towards your friends, towards your children, in your work relationship, etc. This separation of context is fundamentally what we call privacy. And you cannot be a sovereign state and fulfilling the responsibilities of a sovereign state towards its own citizens without being able to separate certain contexts while interacting with other sovereign states. And at the end, the main question is, how accountable is the process of that separation of context? And to what extent is the information published, for example, a few decades afterwards? And how transparent is the process of making decisions or making the rules for deciding which information should be shared or should not be shared? And that transparency has been violated structurally in the past. But I do disagree that diplomacy should always be executed in the fully open. You cannot have diplomacy in the open.
I partly agree to you. A government should have certain secrets. But a thing you see now is that they kind of lost it with the big fear factory they have built up. They can't say if there is a supposed threat, if there is a supposed colibri, God knows what, in the water, because people will go mad and then they will go against their own government. So they are now losing it. They can't do any damage control, apart from really keeping everything secret. Because if you release something, or if the government would release something, they would all go panicking around. And that's why I actually like Mitch's project about turning TVs off, because media is a big fear factor in this big equation, working very close with the governments. And you don't agree?
Media, at the end of the day, especially commercial media, is not really intended in keeping fear up for the sake of keeping fear up. Fear is a interesting way of getting eyeballs to advertisement, and period.
But the end result is that the more you watch are involved with modern media, the more fearful you are, and the more easily we're controlled when we're fearful.
I do agree, but my point is, do not mix up the ends for the means.
Yes, yes.
But you end up in getting into conspiracy theories, and, well, extraordinary claims require extraordinary evidence, and do not explain what by malice what can inadequately be explained with stupidity or
competence. It's not that there's people pulling the strings and making this huge conspiracy of controlling population. It's just the big picture is with the end result of having a fearful population, which is more easily manipulated. And it seems to be that it's all about individuals working for their perceived self-interest, and here we have a bunch of people running the biggest military and economic might, acting very much like a bully for the rest of the world, because there are a whole bunch of people running this government who are military contractors, energy producers, and they make a lot of money when there are weapon systems to be made. When Halliburton can benefit greatly by having an oil pipeline built in Afghanistan, or prepare for war, to fix up Iraq after the war, et cetera, et cetera. There are a bunch of individuals in what I would call my government benefiting greatly by manipulating these things for their own perceived self-interest. And the media, like you said, they sell lots of advertising because they get more eyeball time when people are afraid. Fear sells, it's drama. And we have to carefully choose about the media we let into our lives and what we do with the time left remaining in the precious time remaining in our lives. So, having a government such as what I'll call mine again, protecting not the interest of the security of our nation, but protecting embarrassing, to say the least, information get on that hurts the individual's perceived self-interest seems to me what all of these things that are classified now, it's not for national security, it's for the protecting these individuals' perceived self-interest. And this is where having people getting together for things like OpenLeaks or WikiLeaks and others can be really beneficial, because you cannot have a democracy full of voters without having an informed electorate. So, you know, what is okay to release and what isn't is going to always be a huge matter of debate. But we do need to have these outlets, since there's currently no other ones.
The point I think I was trying to jump in on earlier, and Walter, I do have tremendous respect for your point, but at the same time, the privacy of governments and the privacy of government information is a privilege. It's not a right. It's a privilege that is granted by the people. It is granted by the people whose government that, in theory, is. And if anything, the WikiLeaks episode has told us that government has abused that privilege. And I think so abused that privilege to the point where they, for the immediate future, no longer deserve it. And that until we get to a point where government realizes that the ability to have secrets is a privilege, that they shouldn't be entitled to it. And at the same, and another argument to draw this back to hackerspaces, the argument saying that, well, government cannot function without secrets, strikes me as tremendously similar to the argument we heard circa 2007 that, you know, we cannot have radically inclusive hackerspaces, that there's no way that that could possibly work. That, there's all those weirdos and, you know, those other people out there that, you know, what if they come and steal our stuff, and what if they take our things, and what if they, do all these awful things. And I can agree, it was inconceivable even to me that, we could have radically inclusive hacker spaces. And I was advocating for something that was perhaps a step back from radically inclusive hacker spaces. And this goes to the two examples that are consistently cited, NYC Resistor in New York and NoiseBridge in San Francisco. NoiseBridge adopted the radical inclusion policy. And yes, that comes with a cost. There is a slightly higher instance of drama, but radical inclusion works. A government can exist without having to hold secrets. And we see NYC Resistor, which started off as a more closed system where people had to be vetted and things like that. That regime at NYC Resistor no longer exists. Anyone's open to become a member. Their new facility is basically open as much as NoiseBridge is. Not quite as much, but for all intents and purposes is. And that it is possible to have an effective government that is run without secrets. And if we're going to get out of a world where profit is to be made from war and where people have more to gain from erecting walls rather than tearing them down, we have to figure out ways of doing things completely differently. And I think our community is on the forefront of that and forcing that hand and forcing people to find things and do things in a better way that doesn't allow the kind of abuses that Mitch was talking about.
I think the tearing down walls instead of putting them up is the end point here, is that secrets are useful when countries need to keep secrets from each other, which is one of the things that I like so much about the hacker and hacker community, is that more and more the people who facilitate those spaces and attend those spaces like hanging out at other places, and they like seeing what they can learn from each other. And if our government structures followed a similar route, what all would be better? I mean, I'm not going to get all like hippie with end all wars, but we, you know, if we open it up, then we're going to learn from each other.
I quite like to change the topic towards radical inclusiveness of hackerspaces, because if you have a radically inclusive hackerspace, you probably have just traded your formal rules for inclusiveness for informal mechanisms of excluding other people. I know, it's deeply cynical.
Let me address that. Every hackerspace is unique, but most hackerspaces, and all of them that I've visited, which is probably about 200 of them so far, there are many more, are welcoming to everybody. But that's not to say that every hackerspace is for everyone. So NoiseBridge, I co-founded NoiseBridge very consciously with that notion, having it be welcome to everybody, but knowing that it's not for everyone. So we started it with a very particular culture that suited me and Jake Applebaum, who were the two people who came up with the notions and talked about it endlessly at Camp 2007, knowing we would come home and start NoiseBridge, home being San Francisco. And, you know, being anarchist, hippie, weirdo types, we wanted an anarchist, hippie, weirdo type culture, which would attract more people that we wanted to hang out with. We did not want to be exclusive. We want to be welcoming. Everyone is welcome to come to NoiseBridge, whether you're a member or not. In fact, I gave away 30 keys at 27C3 to people who are not members of NoiseBridge. We have hundreds and hundreds of keys out in the world. Everyone is welcome to come. It doesn't mean that they're going to like it. But the thing is, we don't exclude anybody. We let people who want to stay, stay. And if people who don't want to, you know, don't jive with what we're doing, they eventually go away on their own.
What I'm fascinated by is not necessarily only by hackerspaces, but also by, for example, open source communities or free software communities, depending on what you consider politically correct is, that at the end of the day, you see very similar interaction patterns emerge in there. It comes to participation of women in open source development or in hackerspaces, they're pretty rare in either environment. Especially, I've only seen one hackerspace. I'm a pretty early participant in RevSpace in The Hague, and other than that, I haven't hardly ever seen, but even there you see similar patterns emerge as in open source development, fairly masculine, and I'm a male chauvinist white pig, basically, but this macho behavior on open source developer lists kind of re-emerges in interactions and hackerspaces, and I'm still wondering how to crack this nut, how to fix this, because this, and that's what I meant by, although you're radically inclusive, fundamentally, you're, at the end of the day, you're excluding people who do not fit in the mold of being rather assertive, very much on being willing to play both on the person and on the ball. And how to fix that bit? If you want to be radically inclusive, you have to find patterns to at least make those phenomena or these ways of interaction more palpable to people who are not fit in the mold of kind of verbally beating up each other.
Yeah, well, I'd love you to come to a place like NoiseBridge and see how it works, because it's really not that way with us. NoiseBridge, you know, has approached, you know, like 100 members, and when I was treasurer the first year of NoiseBridge and kept track of all the membership, we were 40% female. It's a very diverse set of people, very diverse, with very diverse interests, you know, not just with high tech, with hardware and software, but also with craft and art and photography, music, video, food. And so we actively set out to have things that I'll call traditionally were male roles and female roles, and tried to give outlet for all of these things, knowing that as time goes by, there's nothing inherent in a male or a female brain that says that boys don't sew and girls do, or that girls don't do soldering and boys do. So as time goes, and in fact, you know, MIT is over half female now, and which it should be, because there's 53% females in the world. But so NoiseBridge isn't exclusive this way because it's diverse, which is different than the open software projects, or, you know, particular open software projects.
Maybe one last statement, but we have to close the round because we're running out.
Okay. Our first fix was not trying to fix it. We tried for a month thinking about, okay, how can we get to women? Like, how can we make it more attractive? Well, don't think about it. It's like, it's going to come natural. So we started doing stuff for everyone. We don't really distinguish between anything. So it's that brings people in. And also radical inclusion. I would love to just call it just normal inclusion. It's normal. It's like everyone is welcome. That's normal. No one's radical. What's radical? Come on. Serious. Thanks.
Okay. say it's nearly impossible to adhere something because you all have been doing such a great job here, and this discussion is going on really, really well. And so it's sad for me to look at the clock and see that we have only 5 minutes left, and the last point, which I promised Estera not to exclude, is that we want to talk a bit about at least the definite things we can say for 2011, and these are the upcoming hacker events. And I think all of you know something. I only have a co-moderator who is busy.
Oh, God, yeah.
And a list in front of myself where I see, first of all, the camp, the Chaos Computer Club camp.
Well, everyone should go to whether they know it or not. It's the most spectacular, amazing thing possible.
And actually this year, 4 years ago, Hackers on a Plane came to the camp in 2007, and that launched the International Hackerspaces Movement, kickstarted, I'm not going to say launched. And this year, we've already sold tickets for the Hackers on a Plane to the camp, and we're, you know, thanks to our travels in Japan and people that we met there, we're going to be gathering hackers from Australia, leaving from Sydney, from Tokyo, from Sao Paulo in Brazil, Seattle, San Francisco, Los Angeles, New York, and Washington, D.C., and get them all to the camp. And unless they close the airport and tear up the airfield, actually hopefully land some of these hackers on the camp, because I think something big is coming up this summer in 2011. I have a feeling of what it is, but if you're looking to be at the ground level, the starting point of something really big, just like if you were at the camp in 2007, you were at the starting level of this, you know, new wave of hackerspaces. Quit your job, take time off, save money, you know, eat ramen. You must be at the camp this summer.
You're just listening to the best advertisement for a CCC event ever.
I know, I should get free membership. What's up with that?
So actually, is there going to be a hope this year?
Not 2011, but 2012.
I heard some rumors about sort of a mini hope, or is it just rumors?
I know nothing. Well, all I know is every 2 years we do this, as long as there's a hotel in the city to have it in.
Then I have the PH Neutral. I think that's the last time in this form. Hakito Ergo Sum. Wherever or whatever this is, maybe someone knows more.
Well, since I'm a creator of it, then I'm going to talk about that. That was a fragmentation, the cellular division of Hackerspace Fest was one of the offspring, is Hakito Ergo Sum. So it's going to be from the 7th to the 9th of April. And we are going to try to have the first actually English-speaking hacker and security conference related to actually basically hacking in English-speaking form there. And that's basically something French are not very good at. So I'm going to try to have that happening. And we are going to have also Estive Numérique, which is some kind of camping in 1700 meter-high mountain in the Alps. We had last year. So since there's every 4 years a camp, and every 4 years there's a hacker event in Netherlands, well, every 2 years in between, we'll try to have Estive Numérique so that we can enjoy the French Southern Alps, and basically,
French
for 2012.
Wow. other things we have to mention is ETH Zero. There is HITB Amsterdam.
Yep, it was basically last year. It was the first time that Hack in the Box, which is a security conference that has mostly been taking place in Asia, came to Amsterdam, and that was a brilliant success. So they are going to do that again. Don't ask me when exactly. It's somewhere in my schedule, but it's going to happen. But unfortunately, we are really out of time. I put some music on already.
Oh, my God. Okay, good. Then we have the NinjaCon in Vienna, the last one that will happen. This should be somewhere around June. Then we have Mitch, who will have a tour. He can give us in the last, I don't know, minute.
Ten seconds.
Yeah. Well, there's so many hackers conferences around the world and hacker events that there's no way you could possibly go to them all because many of them are simultaneous. CohogCon and in Providence, Rhode Island. There's Nauticon in Cleveland. I'm brain dead, so I can't say anymore. So
that's perfect. So I thank you all for participating in the show. It was great, and I hope the listeners enjoyed it as well, and we can hear much more feedback from you. And this was it from us from 2010, and Happy New Year!
Like to listen, but I'm a poor machine, so how could I get high? How could I get high? I'm the silicon to be rested for high. I would give surely some of my integrated in order to smoke some of this nice sticky weed. I can't support this fake, my process is freezing. Open the science gate and let your PC in. How could I get high? I'm just silicon. Could be rest of our eyes.